In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Why, yes, let's indeed. It's time to talk movies. Lobby. Pass the Popcorn, brought let's to you by the Bangor Drive-In. We're joined by Alan Adams of The Main Edge. Hello there, Al.
Well, hello, sir.
How are you on this beautiful Monday?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Shorts are on, feet are up, life is good.
Oh, yeah, that's how you want to be.
You know, I can take this quarantine thing a whole lot better when it's like this.
Yeah, well, just the idea, you know, feeling like you can, you know, even if it's just going out and standing outside, like, at least you're not surrounded by the same four walls you've been staring at for 2 months.
Exactly.
So it's nice to have a little bit of something to sort of just mix it up a little bit.
Yeah. How was your weekend?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I actually, responsibly, I might add, I got out and actually played a round of disc golf with a buddy of mine yesterday. It was actually really nice. Like, everyone was very, respectful, of spacing. Like, everybody was like just about everybody I saw had a mask. Not everybody was wearing it, like, throughout, because, you know, if it's just you and your playing partner, like, and you're maintaining distance, you don't need to mask up. But everyone was really conscious of everybody else's sort of presence in a way that, well, like, watching the news and stuff, I was a little surprised, if I'm gonna be honest about it. Like, I mean, I figured there were going to be some jerks out there, but there really weren't. Like, everybody was really, really respectful, and it made me feel much better about, 'cause I was apprehensive about going out, just because I've been, I've been trying to be very, very careful about all of this, but it was good. It was nice to see the rest of humanity behaving in a responsible fashion.
Well, so I think what you're saying is that those people who play disc golf are just better people than the norm.
I mean, I'm not saying that. it was nice. It was, and just, I don't know, just doing something active and feeling without feeling like I or anyone else was in any sort of elevated risk was really nice. It was really nice.
Good. Well, I'm glad you got to get out and enjoy that. Well, let's talk movies. You did manage to see, holy cow, 3 over the weekend. Where do you want to begin?
I did. Do you want to talk about the pretty good movie, the really bad movie, or the outright bonkers movie? Because we got one of each.
Well, let's work our way up to outright bonkers. Let's start with pretty good.
I was really apprehensive when I first heard about Scoob, because I'm someone, like, full disclosure, like, I don't have any objectivity when it comes to Scooby-Doo. Like, I was raised on all things Hanna-Barbera, and I have a real deep affection for those characters. And so I saw some of the trailers and this computer-generated animation and, like, and all that stuff. It's just, I'm always a little leery. I wasn't surprised, because we live in a world where all pre-existing intellectual property is fair game for cinematic reinvestigation. So it's not a surprise that that happened. The surprise came when I watched the movie, and it wasn't bad. Like, it was actually okay. I was pleasantly surprised by the quality of the animation. The script was solid. Absolutely top tier voice cast, and brace yourself, Rich. This is apparently intended to be the jumping off point for an animated Hanna-Barbera cinematic universe.
Oh, now you got me. I like the sound of that. Now, my big worry with Scoob is, can anybody do it the way Casey Kasem did it?
Well, you know, it's funny, because first of all, Frank Welker voices Scooby-Doo, and he's been playing the part for the last, like, 20 years or something like that. He's actually the original Fred, but he moved over to Scooby, like, I don't know, like 20, 25 years ago, and he's been playing the part ever since. And he's the only sort of, like, old-school cast members that's here. But Shaggy in this one, voiced actually kind of nicely by Will Forte.
I can see that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. like, and not trying to do like a Casey Kasem imitation, because that voice was so iconic and that that interpretation was so iconic. Like, basically trying to maintain the spirit of the thing without trying to, you know, imitate it, which I think is the absolute right move when you're doing something like this. But yeah, the basic gist is they give us a little bit of an origin story. Scooby's a young stray on Venice Beach, just trying to make his way, and he winds up encountering a young Norbert Shaggy Rogers, and instant bond. They go home, and that's when the young pup receives his name of Scooby-Doo. That very Halloween, the pair is out. They get their candy stolen by bullies and helped by some new friends, young Fred, Daphne, and Velma turn up. And so we have that childhood relationship established, which immediately leads to them accidentally breaking up a significant burglary ring, because that's what the mystery gang does. And you'll love this, Rich. This was one of those things where it was just like, it was a moment where I realized that the filmmakers were taking into account those of us with very strong feelings about the previous iterations of the characters. The sort of growing up montage, they used where are the Scooby-Doo, where are you, like, opening sequence.
Oh.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
I do.
And they basically used that to translate them into adulthood, well, young adulthood. And it was phenomenal. And they recreated it beautifully, and it was just one of those things where it's like you got that little nostalgia tingle where it was just like, oh, okay, so they do get it. Okay, so let's see where this goes. And then the story itself is pretty ridiculous. It turns out that Simon Cowell shows up and wants to take Mystery Inc. global. And it is actually Simon Cowell. Like, he voices himself. But he thinks Shaggy and Scooby are a drag on the team. They wind up going off to be sad about it, and wind up getting wound up in Dick Dastardly's plot. I'm not going to spoil what his plot is. It's sufficiently convoluted for a Hanna-Barbera villain. I'll put it that way. So Shaggy and Scooby wind up hanging out with the Blue Falcon and Dynamite. Blue Falcon, who is actually the son of the original Blue Falcon, voiced, frankly, it's an absolutely wonderful choice by Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, yes, yes.
As the sort of dim-witted large adult son of Blue Falcon.
Fantastic.
Which was fantastic. There's the big plot happens, and, you know, will the Scooby Gang save the day? I think you could probably figure out how that's going to play out. But yeah, I really enjoyed myself. Like, it was a nice little nostalgia fix. Like, I think the kids are going to really dig it. Like, there's some good jokes, some pretty well executed set pieces, tugs on the heartstrings. There's the message of the importance of friendship and all that stuff. It's nice. I mean, it's not great. It's not going to blow you away or join the sort of pantheon of great animated fare, but that doesn't mean it's not worth your attention. Like, it's simple and silly, but it just felt like a really good representation of the spirit of the source material. So, like I was saying, if you're someone who has fond memories of these characters, you're going to have a good time. And it should be noted that at least one other iconic Hanna-Barbera character plays a significant part. Captain Caveman turns up.
Nice.
Voiced by Tracy Morgan, who is awesome.
Wow.
and then we have an end credit sequence where a number of other Hanna-Barbera favorites sort of turn up in a little bit of a tease as to what may be coming forward. We'll see if they're able to follow through with the plans they seem to have. Like, the current situation may have altered the trajectory they're in. Although, I haven't seen any hard numbers yet, but word on the street is that it was a wildly successful weekend for it. The equivalent of the same sort of weekend that Trolls World Tour had last month. And if that's the case, then they're probably going to be okay.
That sounds good. Well, now I'm looking forward to seeing it. Fantastic. All right, let's move to just bad. Can I guess which one? I'm going to go with The Wrong Missy.
Yeah, you nailed it. What, you don't think Netflix original movie produced by Adam Sandler's production company starring David Spade sounds like a good movie, Rich?
I'm going to say no.
That seriously, it was like you hear the you see it, and it's like, wait, is it? I mean, I know time has lost all meaning, but is it 1996? Like, what is going on right now? Yeah, it's just such a it's so bad. Like, it's David Spade as a romantic lead, which is terrible on its face. You know, and it's got it's basically got the checking all the boxes of the Netflix Happy Madison sort of formula, which is which basically leaves you with something that's dumb, kind of unpleasant, and woefully unfunny.
That's a good trifecta.
So Spade stars as this guy Tim, who's an executive at some sort of vaguely defined financial company. He's been struggling socially since his fiance left him for another dude that he works with. So there's that. We actually meet him when he's on this disastrous blind date with this free-spirited crazy person named Missy, played by Lauren Lapkus, who honestly deserves so much better than this movie. And it goes so horribly that he winds up jumping out of a bathroom window to escape the date. Months later, he's still, sort of flying solo, hasn't quite got past the trauma of that bad date, but the corporate retreat is coming, and there's a new owner of the company, and so he has to go and make a good impression, and so his buddy, the head of HR, played by Nick Swartzen, the sort of Adam Sandler regular, is, basically trying to coax him into finding someone to take. There's this chance encounter at an airport where he meets a woman named Melissa and is like, oh, wow, like this is like we have so much in common. We read the same books and we have the same attitudes about life. And this is great. And she's beautiful. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to take a shot. And so he texts her and says, I'm going on this retreat. It's on some tropical island. They never say which one. And he's like, we're going to go. What do you say? And she says, sure. So he's on the plane waiting for her to show up. And Rich, he texted the wrong Missy.
Oh, who saw that coming?
Right. And so the crazy woman is on the plane and they're going off to a tropical paradise for the corporate retreat with everybody that he works with and his new boss, et cetera, et cetera. And
let the hijinks commence.
Yeah, it goes about how you would expect, Rich. that's pretty much it. But again, she's the wrong Missy. But and hear the movie out. What if she isn't?
Oh, yeah. A twist.
that's it. It's not good, man. It's one of those things where it feels like the script was like rejected by Sandler for not having enough nuance.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so he's like, so he threw a bone to his buddy. It's just the standard, like no real jokes, like, the sort of tropical setting, like the working vacation vibe that so many of the Sandler Netflix movies have. And it's built on this foundation of like this cringiness. And I'm not averse to cringe comedy. Like there's a place for it. And I think there's a lot of fun that can be had, with awkwardness if you have the right people in place. But this cranks the cringe factor up and then forgets to include the jokes. And so it's just off-putting for the sake of being off-putting. Like, honestly, there were stretches of this movie. Sheridan and I were watching it together. She's sitting on the couch, like, with her arms wrapped around herself. She's so uncomfortable with the way the people on screen are behaving. It's that much. It's that too much. And so it's just not good. None of the performances are good. Like Spade can't carry a movie. He's just not built for this. The usual suspects are here. Sandler's wife is in this movie. Rob Schneider shows up to do something that is kind of maybe racist. It's always hard to tell with him.
Yes.
And even like Lauren Lapkus, who is wonderfully talented, she's trying so hard. Like she's doing her best to spin, crap into gold, and it's just not happening. Like she's the one I feel the worst for out of everyone here. Like honestly, like this is how it boils down for me. the fact that I resent this movie for stealing time from me during this period in my life when time has no meaning tells you everything you need to know.
Wow. Wow. All right. So that leads us up to the grand finale here. I can't wait to hear about Capone.
Rich, I don't even know where to start.
Oh, yes, you do.
Oh, my God. It's so, like sometimes you just have this movie experience that's just unlike anything that you've ever experienced before. We're not talking about, like, good or bad. Like we're in a realm where you can't really make those simple definitions. Like, we're talking about a movie that's bad good or good bad, or, you know, it's like wildly uneven, and it's got elements that are excellent but also elements that are just awful. Like, that's the kind of movie Capone is. Like, it transcends the idea of good or bad. Like, it's this passion project from writer director Josh Trank, who has basically been in director's jail for the past 5 years, the utter disaster that was 2015's Fantastic Four reboot. Like, yeah, that was a complete flop in every conceivable sense, to the point where basically everyone in Hollywood was like, yeah, maybe you need to time out, Josh, because that was bad. But so he's basically, I guess, spent 5 years brooding and working on this script for this movie that is such a jarringly weird viewing experience that I don't know how to use general terms to describe the quality. Like, I mean, the choices are just vividly unpleasant, and the narrative flow is inconsistent, and it's all sort of like thrown into sharp relief by the fact that Tom Hardy, who's playing the titular role, he's playing Al Capone, is just pinning the needle. Like, he is like going for it in ways that only a certain select few are capable of going. And it just, like, it's this movie that just utterly fails to work in just any number of ways, and yet you can't stop watching it. like you're watching it through your fingers almost, but you're still watching it. Like, it's like a roadside accident. Like it's unfortunate, and it's possibly gruesome, but you're still fascinated, and you still want to know like what's going on. So. So Hardy's playing Al Capone at the very end of his life. Like, he's out of prison from the tax evasion charges, but he's suffering a rapid cognitive decline due to the effects of syphilis, which he's had for decades. And so it's really proving detrimental to his mental faculties, and those changes are sort of snowballing. Like, it's coming much, much faster. So he's living in exile in Florida, and he and his family are just the struggle to reckon with the sort of the crumbling of his mind. Like, he's belligerent, he's confused, he's combative, and I'm mentioning this because Josh Trank makes a very strong point several times to make sure we know he is incontinent. There are multiple scenes in this film where Al Capone soils himself. So that's the kind of movie we're talking about.
Wow.
There are, like, vivid hallucinations, like visions of his past sort of blending in with sort of the present-day paranoia. Like, his family's around. His wife, May, played by Linda Cardellini, who has sort of carved out a niche as the sort of wife figure to these sort of over-the-top, like, white dude Italian guys. His son's there, his sister. And, some holdovers from his sort of previous incarnation as mob boss. But it's made very clear that we're looking at someone who's a shell of what he used to be. Like, it happens very quickly, the cognitive stuff disappears just as quickly. That's his dignity goes too. Like, and those failures are presented unapologetically and extremely viscerally. It gets very visual. It gets very gross, and all this time, like, the timeline's wobbling because, you know, reality's falling apart for this guy, and, like, he's our sort of window into the film. So, like, different people are wandering through this sort of slurry of memory and hallucination, like, dudes who may be alive, may be dead. We're not really sure what their deal is, and, you know, he just basically, you know, the man he is just vanishes. And that's kind of it. Like, there's not a lot actually happening in this movie. It's more of a character study, I guess. The events of the film matter only in their relation to his decline, to the point where, like, there are only a couple of scenes that take place outside of his immediate vicinity, and when they do happen, it's kind of jarring. It's almost like they're pulled from a different film almost. But again, like I say, that's jarring. There's a lot about this film that is jarring, I don't know exactly what Trank's end goal was with this movie. Like, it's so ambiguous, but there's an uneasiness to the ambiguity. Like, it's blurry, and we're clearly supposed to sort of relate that to the sort of opacity, the inconsistency that comes with dementia. But I mean, it's only like occasionally it's effective, but for the most part, it just muddies the waters, and it makes it very difficult to follow what's going on, and we're sort of left to piece things together on our own. And I don't think there's anything wrong inherently with challenging the viewer, but there's got to be a payoff. There's got to be something that worthwhile to that. And there really isn't that here. But, okay, so we have to talk about Tom Hardy as Al Capone, because, again, holy crap. I mean, it's... you know, and there are people out there, and I consider myself one of them, who sort of slot Hardy into that kind of character actor trapped in a leading man's body kind of camp. I think he's incredibly talented. Like, I think he's an amazing actor. But he's got some weird tendencies. We hear the stories, like, his usual MO is, like, he likes to wear masks, do weird voices, and, like, generally just sort of conceal himself layers of artifice. And he does that here. Like, there's a ton of makeup, and he's got this weird sort of gravelly, sort of wavering voice, does a lot of grunting. Like, a lot of his dialogue is just monosyllabic. Like, he doesn't engage a lot in that respect. Like, physically, he's quaking and stumbling and shouting all the time. Like, and then again, this is an undeniably, like, big performance, like capital B big. Like, he is the way I looked at it was it's not a best actor performance so much as a most actor performance. Like, he's doing a lot, and he's doing it, like, he basically turned it up to 11 and snapped the knob off. And again, like, there are aspects of the performance that are legitimately great and warrant praise, but there are more where you're sort of confused and almost want to just sort of admonish him and be like, well, all right, mate, Tom, like, we get it, but maybe pump the brakes just a little bit. The rest of the cast, they don't matter. Like, they're fine, but they don't matter. Like, it's just like, and you could tell that everybody in the film basically they got there, and, like, after the first day, looked around and were like, well, Jesus, look at Hardy. Like, nobody's going to pay any attention to us, so why worry about it? And they're not wrong. Like, it's hard to look at anything else other than him, and he's very present and very screen dominant. And ultimately, what it boils down to is I'm fascinated that this movie even exists. Like, not only is it a passion project for a dude who spent 5 years, like, in the hinterlands because of a drastic big-budget failure, somehow gets someone to pay for this movie, makes it, just as an aside, literally no distributor wanted to buy this movie. Like, they finished it, and it was good to go, and nobody wanted it. And so, you know, all this happens, and so it makes the leap to VOD. And so what you get is a movie that is weird and confusing and pretty gross. It's a movie that kind of revels in how aggressively off-putting it is. And it features one of his generation's best actors just going full on off the rails, unapologetically. The truth is, the biggest benefit to seeing this movie is just so you'll have the firsthand knowledge that, yes, this happened, and it really is that strange.
Wow. I almost want to see it just to be able to talk more about it.
Right, like, it's and again, it, like I said, like, it's watchable. It is watchable as hell. It is not. I don't know. It's so beyond like, oh, that was a pretty good movie, or that movie was bad. It's like it's in a whole different conversation that I don't necessarily have the vocabulary to have. Like it's that weird.
Wow. Well, there you go. Three movies, three completely different reactions from our friend Alan Adams of The Main Edge. Alan, thank you as always.
Hey, my pleasure.
Good talk with you. Hope the rest of your week goes well, and we'll get together again next Monday.
Thanks. You as well, man. We'll see you soon.
Sounds good. Alan Adams with us on Downtown.